On Finance and Revenue, it's June the 11th, 2007, and at this time I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3265 as amended in the House. And the Treasurer's Office is going to come up, and I believe since Mazen's not here, we're going to have an explanation of the bill from the Treasurer's side of the issue. So.
Secretary's not here, but it's in his brains.
Are you going to talk about your new building and whether it meets land use requirements?
Yeah, I know. We're rolling through.
No, we're just messing around.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, other member of the committee.
No, there's another one.
Okay. Yeah. Members of the committee. I think you were looking for an overview of the bill, or I think... This is the a bill from the Oregon Law Commission that the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission and the State Treasurer brought this to the Law Commission as a project. It's an overview of three chapters of the state and local bonding authority for the for all public authorities for bonding. And you will hear in the testimony here today that the work group for the Law Commission has done an overview of the whole, all the borrowing statutes, has condensed three chapters down to two. And your testimony from the Treasurer and from the Chair of the Law Commission, who is also the Chair of the work group, and the folks that are here today will go over this bill for you in a fair amount of detail. I believe you will also have a report from the Law Commission that does a section-by-section overview as well. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to the State Treasurer and to the Chair of the Law Commission. Thanks.
Good morning.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning, committee. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. It's a pleasure to be back before this committee again. This is one of those bills that I think, as you see in your packets, probably one of the thickest bills that you're going to have this session, I believe. This is an amended bill, so there's been a lot of work in putting this together. This did, as Kate indicated, is a bill submitted by the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, and this commission every session comes up with some bill, not of this magnitude, but of some size, to try to address some of the complexities and nuances of selling bonds, both in terms of at the state level and at the local government level. And so over the years, we have watched the statutes be changed as a member of the committee, as a former legislator, now as treasurer. One of the things that I've been concerned about since becoming treasurer is making sure that we have an opportunity to go back and look and make sure we're keeping up with the times. And as a result of that, we have asked the State Law Commission, through the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, to look at the statutes, which, again, as you see before you, are even this is a cleanup bill, are very long and complex. And before you run screaming out of the room, I want to say this is a very important bill that will better help local governments and state governments more timely and less costly sell bonds in the marketplace. I have worked with the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission and the Law Commission, and I want to thank Lane Shetterly and as the chair, as well as the staff for the commission and my staff for working on this long, comprehensive bill and to bring this forward. It had great support in the House. I anticipate and hope that it will have support here. This is one of those bills that, again, while it may not make the front page of the Oregonian, it is one of those that will be very, very helpful for many, many years to come in making sure that both at the state level and local governments have good, streamlined access to the marketplace. This bill will reduce three complex chapters of our ORSs, which have number of conflicting languages and concepts, down to two. So based on the underlying principle of this bill of consistent and understandable laws, which we all want to make sure happen, this is a modernization of our existing laws to bring them forward so that we again have one of the best practices by the state and local governments in selling bonds. I urge you to support this bill. There's been an enormous amount of work, 2 years plus worth of work, endless hours, donated time by a number of bond lawyers. I truly believe this is one of those comprehensive bills and monumental bills that will, again, serve the state for years and years. So with that, I'd be happy to turn it over to Lane Shutterly, another proponent of this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shutterly in front of you this morning in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, created in 1997 to engage in a continuous program of law reform, particularly in areas that might not otherwise attract significant attention from the regular legislative process. This certainly is one of them. It tends to be seen as dry and arcane, but as the Treasurer testified, it is critical to the operation, the efficient and cost-effective operation of government from the state to the local levels. You've heard testimony from Kate Richardson already about the scope of this project, from the Treasurer as well. All I will add will be to point to the work group members that are on page, they're named on page one of your packet that is in front of you this morning. These are probably the brightest minds and the most experienced professionals in the state in the area of government bonding and borrowing. We were able to bring them together to assist the Law Commission through their service in this work group. So this package has been brought to you with great care and attention by the most knowledgeable people in this area in the state, and we're very pleased to have had their participation. Three of them are here this morning: Harvey Rogers, private bond attorney in Portland; Doug Goh, also a bond attorney in Portland; and Cynthia Burns, who represents the state of Oregon from the Attorney General's office in the area of bonding and borrowing. They will provide you with the technical overview. I don't need to say any more than this, other than that it's been my pleasure to chair this august group and to shepherd this through to your hearing this morning. We urge your favorable action this morning to get it out to the floor. It's an important bill. It's a timely bill. And I thank you for your attention this morning.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask you two this question. This pulled seven nays and some pretty no names. Do you guys know what the issue was on the House?
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, I didn't hear the floor session. I did get a report of it. There was no speaking in opposition to it. I don't know where that came from. It certainly got unanimous support out of the committee. If I need to be corrected, I think Kate Richardson did watch the testimony, but as I recall, those nays came out with no discussion on the floor.
Correct.
Thanks. Any questions? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
All right, let's have Harvey Rogers, Doug Goh, and Cynthia Barnes come on up, and we'll hear your testimony. We'll let you decide who's going to go first. State your name for the record, and then proceed.
Senator George, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Harvey Rogers.
Harvey, would you pull a mic over closer? Don't get too close, about this far, just right.
Is this good?
That's
good.
Perfect.
All right, thank you. For the record, my name is Harvey Rogers. I'm a partner at K&L Gates. I'm a what's called nationally recognized bond counsel, like Doug Goh on my far left. I'm part of a group that's worked for 2 years on this bill. And what we're going to do is go through the basic provisions of the bill after I give a short introduction. I think Cynthia is going to go through the provisions that affect the state. I'll come back and do the provisions that affect local governments, and Doug is going to respond to hard questions that the rest of us can't figure out. What I wanted to emphasize at the beginning is that we currently have three chapters in the Oregon Revised Statutes. We have one that is exclusively for the state, one that is exclusively for local governments, and one that is for both. And they've been around for a long time, and what has happened over the years is when somebody needs a legal change, they go in and they add something to one of those chapters. We've ended up with three quilts, and they're sort of quilts that have been put together with squares that have been sewn over a long period of time. Some of the squares are bright and shiny and colorful, some of them are kind of faded, and some of them are really funky. And what we've tried to do with this bill is replace those two quilts with three quilts with two freshly woven blankets that all are a single piece that look nice and that work together. So with that as an, and And the reason that this is important, it's not just because the language is more elegant and the lawyers like it. This saves the state and local governments money. When governments borrow money, they're subject to a special rule that doesn't apply to the private sector. If they're not clearly authorized to do something, there is a risk that they won't have to pay the money back. Now, that sounds like it might be a good thing, but lenders know that, and so they get scared. And so if there is a question about the authority of a government to do a particular technique, if there is a question, lenders get nervous, and the effect of that is to raise interest rates or to deny the availability of a technique to a government. So we're here to do this not just because we like the words, but because we think it will save the state and local governments money. Cynthia, would you like to talk about state provisions?
Sure. Vice Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cynthia Burns. I'm not nationally recognized bond counsel. I'm the state's in-house attorney. I represent the Office of the State Treasurer in their bond sales and things like that. I'll give you just sort of a brief overview of why we thought this was necessary from the state side, and then if you'd like, I can go briefly through some of the sections of the bill on the state side. The statutes under which the state issues bonds for many years were scattered around in different agency sections. For many years, state agencies issued bonds basically independently and on their own. There was an entity called the State Bond Commission that I think did some things, but they were sort of out there doing their own thing. In the 1980s, that started to change, and more authority became centralized in the Office of the State Treasurer in terms of overseeing the state's bond sales and coordinating their selling activities and things like that. What happened at that time then was a set of statutes were put in place for the State Treasurer's Office with a lot of notwithstandings, any other provision of law, this is how we're going to do it. So we ended up with sort of this dual scheme of authority out in the agency statutes and authority in the treasurer's office. Over the years, as statutes got amended, that became more and more sort of difficult to manage and interpret because we would end up with two notwithstanding any other provision of law pointing at each other and things like that. So we finally decided enough was enough and it was time to clean those statutes up. So this is an attempt to do that. In the process, we also tried to modernize the authority that the treasurer and agencies have so that it's consistent, and agencies that had more outdated authority the treasurer's office now has sort of authority to fill holes that maybe in agency statutes where they didn't have clear authority to enter into some new kind of borrowing technique, for instance, agreements for exchange of interest rates or things like that. So this was an attempt to fill holes, make sure everybody could do what they needed to do in the bond markets today. One important thing we tried not to do was to take away any existing authority that an agency had. So if they had some unique little thing that they could do, we tried very hard to make sure that that stayed there and we didn't trample on anybody's independent authority. One reason that the bill is so long is that in the process, besides rewriting Chapter 286, we then had to go into the agency statutes and make them consistent with what we were doing. So, for instance, where agencies had, say, their own definition of bond, we got rid of that and pointed it towards Chapter 286 and some other mechanisms and things like that. We tried to put pointers in those statutes back into Chapter 286 so that we would eliminate duplication and potential contradictions. The other thing we tried to do is take out some of the outdated detail that was in the statutes and make them more flexible. For instance, you no longer have a provision that says how you can sign a bond and you know that you have to have the state seal on the bond and things like that. Those things are left up to the treasurer's policies or rulemaking. So the intent was to make this more flexible with changes in the market and to eliminate just some outmoded detail and things like that. So if you'd like, do you want me to go briefly through the sections of the state part in terms of what we did with the treasurer's office and the agencies? Or
let's go ahead and do that. We've been kind of following. I've been following along anyway on the presentation sheet. And so what you guys are doing is really fine. If you want to make specific references, like, for example, the State Treasurer Authority and the reform of the statutes for how borrowing will be done more efficiently, so we know where, exactly where that is.
Okay. Well, the beginning of the bill deals with the State Treasurer's section, which is Chapter 286. It starts out with definitions that you would think would be easy to come up with, but they prove to be challenging, and we're hopeful that they're now modern and will work. Section 3 through 6 are the duties of the State Treasurer now in terms of centralizing his role in overseeing the issuance of state bonds. For many years, the State Treasurer has been the, quote, issuer of state bonds. In other words, he's sort of the final say as to whether the bonds get issued or not. And that authority is continued in Sections 3 through 6, as well as some requirements for the agencies in terms of working with the Treasurer's office. Then in Sections 7 and 8, this is more of a delegation of authority in terms of the mechanics of the bond sales, giving the Treasurer flexibility in terms of structuring a sale and things like that.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
do you have questions as she goes? Or do
yes,
you
let's just do it that way. That would be great.
I have just one real quick one, I think, hopefully. In Section 5, it looks like you're broadening the State Treasurer's authority to charge fees to local governments and other state agencies. It's the other state agencies that got my attention. Section 5, Sub 5, a related agency. Is that basically, I know that, for instance, the area of state government I'm probably most familiar with is transportation, and the Treasurer issues bonds as it relates to highway projects all the time. So under this particular change, the Treasurer then can charge ODOT fees as it relates to those bond issues?
Vice Chair, Senator Starr, members of the committee, the Treasurer's Office can charge ODOT a fee. The Treasurer's Office actually has been able to do that for many years and has done that for many years. There are currently, this was actually another example of how the statutes sort of need to be cleaned up, because there were provisions in Chapter 286 that allowed the Treasurer to charge for bonds, and then there was another provision in ORS 293-250 that said the Treasurer could charge state agencies for the service he's provides in connection with bond sales. And that statute actually let the Treasurer spend the money that he received from the bond sales on any purpose for his office. So we've actually narrowed this to make sure that the money that they collect for bond sales is used in connection with the debt management division and the bond program. And there is a definition in here of a related agency, which is any agency for whom the Treasurer issues bonds. So that really is sort of a continuation of existing authority. If a new bond program comes on board, you know, they will be added to the related agencies in terms of, you know, the Treasurer would charge them for their services in connection with bonds, just like they do the other agencies.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My understanding, since we're right at that area, is that the purpose is to kind of give more detail to the billing. In other words, it won't be broad categories where the Treasurer tries to recover costs, but actually the billing reflect what is actually being done. I see heads nodding a yes. So,
Vice Chair George, members of the committee, the Treasurer, I'm not an expert in how the Treasurer's Office bills, and so you might want to talk to them, but it's my understanding that for many years they've had sort of a two-tiered billing system. One is sort of, one is in relation more to the sale that's going on, and then there is another sort of cost overlay that's been spread out among the issuing agencies based on how much they have outstanding to cover things that aren't related to a particular sale but are part of their oversight responsibilities.
Laura, do you want to?
Yes, what do you think?
For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of the Debt Management Division. As Cynthia was alluding to, there's a number of different fee provisions in state law. There's also a number of mandates that my office and the State Treasurer's Office must carry out. Actually, the area where it's been a little confusing has been more local government services.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of things that we're required to do, including being a clearinghouse for tracking of all local as well as state government debt, and other things where we oversee advanced refundings. There's been a bit of a mismatch because there is silence as to some of our activities, and then there's fee authority in others. Our goal is really simply to make sure that each of our services are costed out and then fees are charged appropriately across all of our different activities.
Mr. Chair, the reason my question is based on the documents council provided us, it basically does say that the treasurer, currently the state treasurer, provides a wide variety of services but charges only for a few. And so that's why I asked the question. Thank you.
I had a question, but I completely dropped it. It must be Monday. Go ahead.
Let's see. So then continuing on, after Section 7 and 8, which are sort of the authority in terms of the mechanics of how the bonds are issued, Section 9 is what you probably know of now as the bond bill. And that's in some part a continuation of existing authority. One change is that we've run into problems at the end of legislative sessions where, or at the end of bienniums where a bond bill wasn't passed yet and there were bond sales in the mix. And so this clearly continues the authority from the last session to get your bonds out the door until a new bond bill is passed. Section 10 is...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
So that would be in a situation where the legislative session ran past July 1?
Correct.
That's not going to happen anymore.
I was about to add that.
We should pass a law.
That'll be done on July the 4th.
Well, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, just in case the unforeseen happens and we run past the end of a biennium, this is here as a fallback because bond lawyers are very conservative and they want every contingency covered. So that's what it's there for. Section 10 is agreements for exchange of interest rates. That is in current law, and this is basically just a continuation of the current law. Section 11 is the same thing. They are they're called tax anticipation bonds here. They're known as tax anticipation notes now. These are short-term borrowing instruments that were put in place a couple of biennia ago to deal with cash flow issues. And again, that's a continuation of current law. Section 15 is calculations with respect to the debt limit. As you may know, many of our bond programs are authorized in the Constitution and have a constitutional limit as to how many bonds can be issued. Some programs also have a statutory limit, and this talks about how you calculate that limit with your outstanding bonds.
And that's consistent with current law regulations. Yes, one thing.
It's a clarification. When we looked at the language, it was a little hard to understand. We're hoping this is better.
I think each of us can see the necessity of making sure that this is very clear, particularly when you're trying to sell these to someone who has those concerns you expressed earlier. Go ahead. Thanks.
Section 17 and 18 are basically technical language dealing with when you issue bonds, you usually pledge a collateral or security interest in some of your revenues or monies in your debt service account to bondholders, and these are technical provisions about how you do that. Section 20 is... again, related to the administration of the bond programs, actually sections 20 and 21 give authority to the treasurer and to state agencies to hire bond counsel, to hire financial advisors, trustees, other experts that they may need in terms of advising them on their bond sales and performing the functions of the bond sale. Section 22 is an important section and a continuation of current law. It makes the interest on bonds issued by the state of Oregon exempt from personal income tax under Oregon law. Section 23 gives the state authority to take actions that are necessary to protect the federally tax-exempt status of the bonds. Often you need to enter into covenants in terms of the uses of the bond proceeds or the interest that may be earned on money while it's sitting in an account pending construction or things like that. And this gives authority for the state to enter into those covenants and to take the actions that are necessary to protect the tax-exempt status under the Internal Revenue Code. And then Section 24 is a very brief section that takes up what is now a lot of sections that deal with the technical requirements. If somebody has an old certificated bond, what they do if they lose it. We thought that that really didn't warrant pages of statutes and could be done by rule. So that's some of what Section 24 is. Section 25, the records of bond ownership have been exempt from disclosure under the public records law for many years, and this continues that authority. Section 26 is also a continuation of current law in terms of the Secretary of State auditing bond programs. Section 27 is the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee, which is, again, a continuation of current law. The one change is this entity receives a report from the Treasurer's Office, and we've tried to tie the reporting requirement here in more closely with the information that the Treasurer's Office develops for the Governor's Office in terms of the recommended budget, so that they weren't having to sort of do the same thing twice. Sections 28 through 32 are the Private Activity Bond Committee. Again, that entity exists under current law. The only change is that the treasurer is now designated as the chair of the committee rather than a member of the Department of Administrative Services. Section 33 talks about a unique kind of bond that used to be issued for higher ed. They were called baccalaureate bonds. They weren't restricted in terms of their use or anything, but they were a tool for people to buy State of Oregon bonds and smaller denominations, and they could use them for their kids' education if they wanted to, but they could use them for anything else, too. And then starting with Section 34, we really sort of start to get into more conforming changes. Section 34 are the lottery bond statutes, and those are just conforming changes to make the existing statutes work with the new changes. And then we go on to local bonds, which I'll let Doug talk about. And starting at the back of the bill, around Section 71, and basically then all the way back, are the conforming changes that were put in with respect to state agency statutes and also local government statutes to make them conform with the changes that are being made in Chapters 286 and 287. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay, go ahead.
So I'll turn it over to Doug,
I guess, or Harvey. Right. Senator George, members of the committee, I'm going to run through the section-by-section summary of state borrowings, which appears in the commission report beginning at page 5 at the bottom. I'd like to begin by noting that really what's going on with the local government chapters is the same stuff that goes on with the state chapter. It's just done differently. The reason it's done differently is that you folks, the legislature, authorize the state to borrow, and then all of the state borrowings are carried out through the treasurer's office. For local governments, it's a different system. There you have independent elected officials, city councils, county commissioners, school board members, who make the decision to borrow, but they do it under the rules that you folks give them. So the principal difference between the first set of statutes that deal with state borrowings and the second set that deals with local governments is that you're providing an overview and authority for other elected officials to take advantage of for the local governments, whereas you're authorizing it directly for the state. I'm sorry, I gave you a bad section reference. Cynthia did page 5. I'm doing page 7 of the report. Section 42 has a counterpart for the state things. It does new definitions. If you compare this to what we had before, we had lots more definitions in the old chapter. So we narrowed it down to the ones we really need, and hopefully we made them a little easier to read. Section 43 and 44 deal with debt limits. They are simply a restatement of existing law. So is Section 45.
Section 46 is another restatement of existing law. That's for something called the Uniform Revenue Bond Act. Again, fewer words here. Section 47 restates the law on short-term local government borrowings. I should add at this point that nothing in these statutes will authorize a government to do a borrowing if the government wasn't previously authorized to do it. What these statutes authorize the governments to do is do the borrowings a little better. They clarify their authority, but adopting this bill won't give governments the ability to run out and do a bunch of different kinds of borrowings they weren't previously authorized to do. Section 48 is kind of a corner piece of the local government statutes. It gives broad, clear authority to local governments to structure borrowings. Mentioned before, when if there's lack of clarity about the ability of a government to do something, it costs them money. This was specifically written to be clear and give authority to governments to structure borrowings to meet market conditions. Section 49 is something that you have sort of automatically in the state. We give local governments the ability for them to delegate to staff some of the important borrowing decisions. Highly useful today where interest rates are popping up and down and market conditions are changing and the elected officials meet infrequently. Section 50 and 51, these deal with the ability of governments to secure debt. It's sort of the government's equivalent of the Uniform Commercial Code. Section 50A it clarifies the ability of governments to secure a borrowing with everything they've got. The buzzword for that for governments is full faith and credit borrowings. Section 52 gives governments the ability to get credit enhancements. Today, most governments go to bond insurers to get bond insurance because it gets them a more favorable interest rate. This provision relates to that kind of practice. Section 53 is interest rate swaps. This was something that the legislature authorized two sessions ago and is a very modern technique that allows governments to save money. This just integrates it with the modernized provisions in the rest of the bill. Section 54, 55, 56, 57, and 59 all relate to the ability of governments to borrow money to pay off outstanding debt. The chief use of this, of course, is to save money when interest rates decline. Section 60 through 63 slightly revise and modernize the statutes relating to the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. That's a commission that was one of the requesters of this bill. It composed of local government representatives, staffed by the state treasurer's office, and it does a terrific job of keeping local governments advised of changes in the financial markets and helps them to borrow cost effectively. Section 64 matches up with a state provision that relates to how you calculate debt limits. Section 66, laws. We've had two major constitutional amendments in Oregon that have been done by citizen initiative that have changed the property tax system and have affected the ability of governments to issue general obligation bonds. They were written by citizens and used a bunch of words that didn't have established meanings in Oregon law, so these provisions tell you what happens if there's a misunderstanding there or a restatement of existing law. Section 67 just says that if the voters approve a general obligation bond, it tells you how to levy a tax for it. Again, a restatement of existing law. Section 68 says that the powers that are granted in this act are in addition to powers that governments have elsewhere. Many governments have separate kinds of separate statutes that relate to borrowing. Section 69 is a technical provision relating to record of ownership of bonds. It's, again, existing law. The Section 70 just says that the changes don't apply to bonds done prior to the effective date of this bill. And not included in this summary is a, or at least not in this list right here, is a provision at the end of the bill that I unfortunately have to give my competitor Doug Go credit for. It's a provision that says if there's something wrong with this bill, you can use existing law prior to this bill being adopted for the next bit until the legislature comes back into session. We spent 2 years on this thing. We really hope there's nothing wrong with it, but it's a great big fat bill, and there might be. If
Harvey, yes, just a question about it. Was there something that occurred that that made that provision? I guess the question's to Doug on that. Where an event occurred?
Chair Deckard, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, Doug Go, for the record, there was not any particular event, Senator, that triggered that. It is a provision that's very common in the federal tax code because of the reason that Mr. Rogers, because despite everyone's best efforts, you don't think of everything. And so this is, the thought was to allow people to use existing law until the next legislative session or until it actually runs through 2009, and so that the legislature can correct our mistakes if we identified those between now and then. But there was not a particular event that triggered that.
Mr. Chairman, I thought that was such a good idea, we had to add it to every bill.
That's the end of the summary of the provisions that affect local governments. Also in the report, the detail starting at page 4 is a list of what we identified as the policy changes this bill makes. Any of us would be happy to go over them if you like. They are listed there in the report. At your pleasure, I can review them or you can ask questions about them.
Questions for this panel?
One question,
please.
The local governments must be okay with this because they're not here nor are they signed up.
Yes, there were local government representatives on the work group. We have responded to questions from a number of folks. As you might expect, when a bill of this size gets out there, people go, oh, what in the world is this? And we've fielded a number of those calls, and I don't think we've had anyone who hasn't been very comfortable with this.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to point that out?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
We didn't open with Mazen's presentation, so that would fit very well.
Great. Mazen has one thing to point out, and he might tell us how his daughter's birthday went at some point today.
I'll stop with that if you want, Mr. Chairman. The policy changes that the bill have put into place, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is probably something that happened just because that needs to be the statement of the law that included policy previously, especially the policy that change enumerated in page 4. This is ABCD, D as in dog. This would have probably interacted with what we would have done earlier this session when we talked about the limit for the bond limit this biennium for the 07-09 biennium. This is when we put the 75% and the 80% of the maximum. So what this allows is a different interaction between the governor and the treasurer and how it interacts within the law. I just want to make sure that this works for a process just like we did this year, Mr. Chair, if in the future that happens.
Do y'all want to comment, whoever would like to, just on section or point number D, section 9, sub 2. Laura Lockwood-McCall is now.
Laura. Oh, my little policy change. I think there's a trend here. My goal, I recommended that we change the law.
Laura, would you stand?
Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management, to the chair and the committee. I recommended that we reflect actual practice. Under existing law, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission was doing several copies, versions of the same report, both prior to the budget adoption, submission to the legislature, and then subsequently. The goal of all of this was for us to provide an annual report on debt capacity that could be used by the governor as he or she is putting together a budget. Then, obviously, by the legislature as that budget's reviewed and modified and debated. The problem is that the timing of when all these different reports were due was not really keeping pace under state law with what we were really doing. So the goal is to clarify that we're giving advice to the governor as to prudent maximum levels. And that's really what this law and this policy change. Before that, if you were to look through old budgets, you'd just see the governor's recommended budget, and we'd have exactly the same numbers.
Huh.
So we're moving from just a advise to a prudent maximum as a goal of what we can provide to the process.
And this is a larger question than House Bill 3265, but we're going through the borrowing decisions right now. I mean, we've been at it for 3 months, and it's clear to many of us that there's a better way to do it. And so I would just encourage the MDAC and the treasurer's world to help us, because I think the one missing element of that is the legislative involvement, and that's where you get this disconnect that we have today, where you have both the treasurer and the governor through the debt, I'm going to miss the name, here, and you have the legislature here in terms of overall debt levels and prudent levels of debt. And this is larger than House Bill 3265, but we now see the effects of that. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Rogers, Ms. Burns, Mr. Goh. Anyone else? I can't believe there would be on House Bill 3265. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 3265.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move amended House Bill 3265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 3265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion. Ordered. And so Senator Courtney will again carry this bill. I've been trying for 6 years to have the Senate President carry the MDAC bill. So we will ask for the committee's help on this one.
Nobody dare ask questions about it.
To have the thickest bill of the year carried by the Senate President. Thank you, Mazin.
We'll have our section sheets on the floor.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
If we didn't open up any other hearings, that was it.
Yeah. Great, thanks. Okay, so we're just going to go right in order. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3455. And Mary.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we continue?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3455A revises the definition of an urban renewal plan's consolidating billing rate to include urban renewal plans that have been substantially amended. Specifically, if an urban renewal plan is a reduced rate plan before it is substantially amended, it remains as such after it has been substantially amended. During the 2001 session, legislation was enacted providing that some urban renewal plans adopted after October 6, 2001, would no longer divide new local option taxes, i.e. give some of the local option taxes to the urban renewal plans. They would stay and be used for exactly what they were voted upon to do. These urban renewal plans are referred to as reduced rate plans, whereas other
plans that continue to apply division of tax on their local options are referred to as standard rate plans. When this legislation was enacted, possible changes in the law were not considered. As a consequence, legislative intent is unclear at this point, and after an urban renewal plan that's a reduced rate plan is substantially amended by either a change in the, by adding land or by increasing the amount of indebtedness, it switches to become a standard rate plan. And the proposal is to allow it to retain its reduced rate nature.
Questions for Mary? Hasina Squires, Greg Frank, and Tom Linhares. And Steve, there you are. If we let the man in the uniform
end.
Yeah, okay. You guys have a prescribed order. If you have a badge, you go first.
Oh, really?
Mr. Chair, let me provide some introductory remarks. Steve Bryant with the League of Oregon Cities, also representing the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. We consider this bill a technical fix that we hope you can endorse. As your staff explained, we have a few of these reduced rate plans in the state. The city of Kaiser is one that I think you'll hear about, where they were caught unawares as a result of a substantial amendment they made to their plan that then caused them to lose the ability to return to their fire district local option taxes that had been previously collected for their fire district. Now, if you adopt these amendments, these urban renewal districts will actually lose revenue. But they had no intention of collecting these revenues, and in fact, they would prefer, especially in the case of the city of Kaiser, I believe, to go ahead and return those local option taxes back to their fire district. So you have this unique situation where, as a result of the changes made in 2001, where you enabled some urban renewal plans to choose what's called this option one methodology to not collect special option or special levy taxes and general obligation bond taxes and accept the fact that they would collect reduced urban renewal funds. A few agencies took advantage of that option, but they have since gone through the substantial amendment process. And as your staff explained, once they do that, they sort of lose their grandfather status of being able to collect or return these taxes for which they were intended. So the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies supports this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Bryant?
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Frank, and for the record, I represent Kaiser Fire District and request that you support House Bill 3455. And basically what happened was that the city of Kaiser, when they substantially amended their plan back in 2005, it reverted from the standard rate, right? And went to the other one, anyhow, sorry. And then we no longer got our 35-cent local option levy tax. And the city of Kaiser went through the process of notifying all the districts about the amendments. It was just an unforeseen consequence, and nobody realized that. And so we've been working with the city of Kaiser, and appreciate the League of Oregon Cities and Special Districts Association of taking this on as well and bringing this to your attention so that it could be fixed. And so what House Bill 3455 does is revise that definition of consolidated billing tax rate to include the existing urban renewal plans, which are substantially amended. Thank you for your time. Urge your support, and I guess that's it.
Thank you, Chief. Questions? Mr. Lynn Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Linhares. I'm the director of the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. One of the commission's responsibilities is coordinating among all of the 37 taxing districts in Multnomah County. We were made aware of this problem last summer, and my first reaction was, no, that can't be right. There's no way it could work that way. Well, when I read the statute, I went, oh, my gosh, somebody really screwed up. In Multnomah County, we have 3,016,547 reasons to support this bill. That's the amount of money that will flow not to the local taxing districts as it was intended, but would instead go to the Portland Development Commission. We have a Option 1 urban renewal plan area, the Central East Side plan area. There was a reduced rate plan area, and when Portland Public Schools passed their local option levy last November, when Multnomah County passed their library local option levy, it was thought that they would collect taxes from the entire value within the Central East Side urban renewal area because it was a reduced rate plan area. Under the current statute, if House Bill 3455 is not passed, that will not be the case. Those taxes will instead go to the Portland Development Commission. The Portland Development Commission is calling me saying, Tom, how do we certify this as a reduced rate plan? And I said, well, you can't unless we get legislation to correct the language of what is a consolidated billing rate. So in Multnomah County, the City of Portland, Portland Development Commission, Portland Public Schools, Multnomah County, are all vitally interested in this bill because it will shift a significant amount of tax money away from the local districts to the Portland Development Commission. And the Portland Development Commission is saying, we don't want it. Central East Side has always been a reduced rate plan. When we went through the substantial amendment last summer, we did not intend to convert it from a reduced rate plan to a standard rate plan. What do we do to fix this? And House Bill 3455 is a way to fix it.
Great. Questions for Mr. Linhares? Tom, I'm glad we've got you. You're valuable to the state in your understanding of urban renewal property taxes, their interplay, and finding statutory fixes. Appreciate all your work.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hasina, are you... You're signed up?
Ms. Squires had to go off to another hearing, and she gives her apologies.
There's no other hearing occurring. Someone go track
well,
her.
She knew she had three good stand-ins, so she felt she left the bill in our capable hands.
About right, three for one. Yeah,
great.
Okay.
That's true. Someone can go check the other hearing rooms. Great. Close the. Anyone else on 3455? Close public hearing on House Bill 3455. Open the work session on House Bill 3455.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 3455 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator George.
I better clarify, that wasn't our amendment, that was House amendment.
Yeah, we have no amendments.
No amendments.
Senator George has moved House Bill 3455 as amended in the House to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections. So ordered. Senator Monroe.
Sure, why not?
You have been taking all the technical, or many of the technical bills.
This one sounds kind of necessary.
It does. It does. Mr. Linhares' testimony was spot on. Open a hearing. Actually, let's go out of order since 2172, 2211, and 2212 are all somewhat related. Let's go to Senate Bill 550 if folks are here for 550. I see a few of them. So let's open a work session on Senate Bill 550. And Ozzy, are the folks, I know you, Mr. Meyer, Chuck, do you need in on this? They got it? Okay. Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Ozzy Rose. I represent the ESD Association, and we're here to encourage you to amend Senate Bill 550 by adding some amendments or an idea that we're working on in Senate Bill 609. And the There are two things being added to the bill. One, and on the amendments, I assume you have the amendments. I'm not certain about that.
No
amendments.
We don't have it right now.
I have one in my office. Paul, did you guys get the amendments? Steve Meyer does?
Sorry.
Here comes Steve.
We should make sure that there's enough for the public to. We won't, since we're just getting the amendments, we won't move anything, but it'll give us a chance to introduce the amendments to the committee. Ozzy.
Do you want Steve to do that?
Sure. Do you have copies of the amendments?
We do not have copies.
What's copies?
So, Ozzy, do you want to start walking us through,
okay,
and then we'll...
There's two issues that we're trying to add to Senate Bill 550. One is that the when we redid the equalization formula for ESDs several years ago, we placed in the language a statement that every ESD would have at least $1 million floor. Mm-hmm. So those small ones that don't generate that much money by their ADM count would have $1 million. But the way we wrote the language... we also had to allow, there's only a certain size pot of money for all the ESDs, and we ran out the distribution and then said, okay, we need this much more to bring up those five small ESDs. And we prorated down every ESD, including those five. So the $1 million floor really became $1 million ceiling, and we never have given them $1 million floor. This next year it'd be $938,000. And this language writes the statute so that the five small ESDs will get $1 million floor no matter what else happens. And that money isn't new money. It comes from the other ESDs. And we're all in agreement that it's the proper thing to do given what we were trying to do when we set up the formula. I'll have to confess, Steve tells me I was on the work group that decided to do it the way we've been doing it, and I just told him, well, I must not have been paying attention at that time. The second point...
Your ESDs are unanimous.
Yes,
on
yes. It's part of our legislative platform.
The million, okay.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah. The second addition is to require a study of the situation with small schools, and it's in Section 8, and the key part of Section 8... it's on page 6, line 16 through 21, and essentially says that we will conduct a study during the interim that identifies the level of funding in small schools and is it adequate to provide sufficient funding for those small school districts. And the issue is, that those of you who've been here a while, and all of you have, ever since we've had a formula based on ADM, there's been somebody with an idea about correcting it to make it better. Whether it's high growth or buildings or what it is. And everybody's had an idea, has had an idea that benefited them at the expense of somebody else. I don't know if you've traced that or not. But this issue is, I think, a compelling issue that the state needs to answer. We need to make sure that every child in Oregon has access to some basic level of education that we expect for them to be successful. Whether it's driven by our testing system or the QM or whatever, there is a set of curriculum that we need to make available to every youngster. And the smaller school districts are having an increasingly difficult time to do that. Over half our school districts have less than 1,000 kids in the district. And we have many high schools in the metro area that have over 2,000 kids in their high school. A fourth of our school districts have less than 500 kids in them. And two-thirds of our districts are getting smaller every year. This is not an Oregon issue, by the way. It's a national issue. That as our populations move to population centers, we are having an increasing number of smaller and smaller communities and small schools. And the question here is, are you assuring that every kid, no matter where they reside in Oregon, has access to an adequate program? And this study says you will connect those two ideas. And I think it makes sense to add it to 550. You've had 550 up the floor, and it came back. And the debate there was, do you do away with the small school correction? 5 years from now, I think, is what that way that was written. The small school correction is a number or formula that we built 15 years ago, and we use it. And it was been adjusted once.
So that wasn't what was in the bill. It was the $5 million outside the formula.
Okay. I'm sorry. But it's essentially the same issue. You take that $5 million away from the small high schools that we've been giving them, and the issue ought to be, are we sure that those schools have access to an adequate program? And we believe tying the study, that the removing the $5 million gives some urgency to the study idea, I think. And I think that's why Rob and the small school people are interested in the bill the way we're proposing it. With that, I will...
So those are two. My understanding, there was four changes that were being contemplated in 550 from current law today.
Looks like Chuck Bennett has something to say.
Okay, so let's bring Chuck up and Senator George.
Ozzy, just the other day I had one of our new charter schools dealing, they have a group of students that are special ed children. The only problem was the money didn't follow those kids. And they're like getting 40% of what they should be getting for the children. If an ESD is providing those services, do the dollars flow through the school district back to the ESD? And if they do that, why wouldn't a charter school be able to receive a significant amount of the money? Because you're delivering a service for special ed children. Are you familiar with this issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, no, I'm not. And the 40% thing kind of surprised me. I thought charter schools get 80%.
Special ed, because it's the first one that's been in the cycle.
Okay.
In other words, most of the time it's assumed that you're just going to accept whatever children are going to your charter.
Mm-hmm.
This is specifically for dealing almost a parallel to an ESD, dealing with special ed children, and the money didn't follow.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator, I don't know the details. I'll have to look into it.
I think somebody's shaking their head that's correct. We need to, that's something we need to correct. I don't. The relating clause is broad enough, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to confound the bill, but does anyone have an answer to that question?
Jim Green does.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Mr. Chair, Senator George. In ORS Chapter 338, which is our charter school law, when a student is federally mandated to receive special ed services, we do a different funding formula than we normally do with charter school students. They get a double weight mm-hmm. through the formula. And because of that, they will get, if they're a K-8 student, 40% of a double weight, which is 80% of a single weight. The reason we did that in ORS Chapter 338 is the student's resident district maintains responsibility for all those federally mandated special education requirements. They have last dollar responsibility. They're legally responsible. They're the ones on the hook to provide the services. If some of those services are coming from an education service district, those services follow that student to the charter school.
Okay, but if it came through the board, it would not. They literally could get 40% of what would be the double weighted.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, that's exactly what a student who not on an IEP would receive for what we call their quote-unquote regular education. Their special education services are going to have to be required to be fulfilled by their resident district wherever that charter school is located.
But what happened? They shifted the children to, you know, to the charter school, and the charter school is expected to meet the IEP, but the money is not following, which makes it impossible to deliver all those services.
Well, no.
And this local district is not providing. I think you probably have an idea what district I'm talking about. And
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not sure which district, but our law is quite clear that the charter school is not responsible for the special education unless there's a contract entered into between that district and that charter school to provide that service. The student's resident district under ORS Chapter 338 maintains that responsibility. Unless they've contracted that and the charter school has accepted that responsibility and the parents have signed off on that, because remember, in federal special ed law, you've got to have all those folks around the table. I guess, Ms. Chair, Senator George, I'd like to have a conversation offline with you about that so we can figure out what's going on and we can get down to the bottom of it. But it sounds like what's occurring under the law is what's occurring with this. I'm not just quite sure how the money's flowing to this charter school.
So some of the districts sent the money appropriately. The others decided not to. They just followed the law. And my issue is, of course, that you're not meeting the needs of the child, and that's a violation of federal law. And I just looked at the relating clause and thought maybe we could clarify that right here. But
we just got the amendments, so we'll discuss them and not work them. since it's related to school finance. And
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, there are a couple other amendments that are coming for this bill, so we appreciated hearing this morning you weren't going to move it. One in particular is in researching the federal timber payments and how that was going to be distributed, we discovered that there is a clause in previous legislation that brings the distribution formula and the whole distribution of those funds to an end on July 1st of this year, and that needs to be updated. And I believe that's in process in council now. In addition, we were taking a look at the formula of that distribution. I'm not sure we would advance anything further on that, maybe looking at that 75-25 in a different light, but have kind of decided that 75-25 looks pretty reasonable. So we probably won't bring an amendment forward on that, but we do want to update that distribution period, make sure that we're current on that. That's just necessary for everybody involved.
Okay, so you're waiting for that?
Yes.
That amendment. Questions on the amendment we don't have before us, but just updating the formula for the federal timber. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. I understand that you have a full agenda this morning, so I'm not going to reiterate a lot of what Ozzy said, but essentially the Dash 2 language to Senate Bill 550 effectively appropriates language from the Dash 6 Amendment to 609, which we introduced originally as a bill representing the three frontier rural ESDs who are uniquely funded. So we're okay with the language. We realize that that there are certain things that, that may or may not be able to be affected this session, and we're okay with that. We appreciate the fact that Senate Bill 550-2 Amendment provides an additional $62,000 for our ESDs, and we can put that to good use. That represents it represents a speech therapist for anywhere from 3 to 6 school districts. So, again, thank you. We appreciate your time, and we certainly urge you to add that amendment to Senate Bill 550. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Ozzy, Steve points out that there's no definition of a small ESD. Is that something that ESDs would want to work out?
Mr. Chairman, it's my belief that the study of small schools and small ESDs addresses whatever we need to call small as we look at curriculum distribution. I'm trying to press that we don't start from the assumption that we identify small by numbers. We identify it by we need to deliver curriculum or program to kids. ESDs, small and large, are going to be helpful in that or fit in that formula or that process. And so it specifically does not try to identify with numbers. The issue is how do you get an adequate program to every kid? And I'm hopeful that we're successful with that discussion better than we have been in the past. Thank you.
So, Ozzy, are you concerned at all that we define that floor, which sounds eminently responsible and reasonable? We define it, we set it by statute, what the floor is following the study, and then given the weaknesses of our revenue structure in the state, rainy day fund aside, inadequate, you have a big recession, you cut 18% of the budget, and what you've done is you've, because of the floor, you've just exacerbated the problem in all the other districts that aren't at that floor.
Mr. Chairman, if you get the direction I'm trying to argue is that everybody will stay at that floor, and you may bring other people down from where they are under your scenario, but the bottom line. And the other part of it is that as you talk about a floor, if you focus on program delivery, what size can actually deliver a program? One answer is to consolidate into larger districts. That isn't a very good answer for a lot of people. Another answer is the use of technology and better instruction opportunities in every school district. Another answer is shared school district services. Another answer is greater use of the ESD in transferring services across not only school district lines, but ESD lines. And I don't know the answers to those things, But the issue is, what are the best and most efficient way to get program to every kid? And the immediate reaction is, what's the floor in money? I'd like to have a discussion for a little while, wait till we decide what is the floor in program access that we want for every youngster.
Okay.
And it's no silver bullet answer to your problem. If we don't have enough money, everybody's going to groan.
Questions? Thank you very much. So we'll wait for the amendments and try to reschedule with the dwindling time we have left in the session. Steve, anything that we missed on 550?
I don't think so. You have the distribution for the $1 million, and once the amendment comes, we are ready to reschedule.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 550. Okay, so back in order now, we'll open a public hearing. So we have three tax credits. Again, none of them are going to move, but we'll get our public hearings on the three different tax credits or incentives that we have. First up is House Bill 2172, public hearing. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2172 directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a goal to reduce the risk of cancer from diesel engine emissions to no more than one case per million by 2017 and to substantially reduce risks to school children by 2013. There are also to establish standards for qualifying repower or retrofit diesel engines. The bill establishes the Clean Diesel Engine Fund and dedicate 75% of the funds available until June 30, 2010 to repower or retrofit vehicles that will be used in Oregon for 75% of their total miles or total hours, 75% of the total hours. And the money is to be used to award grants and loans for up to 25% of the certified costs of qualifying repowers. The bill also requires replaced engines to be scrapped and the repowered engines to have a useful life of at least 7 years. Requires DEQ to conduct audits to ensure engines continue to meet certification requirements, and the bill creates a tax credit of up to 25% of the certified costs for qualifying repower or 50% of certified costs of qualifying retrofits. It disallows the credit in conjunction with the pollution control credit, but does allow the credit to be used in conjunction with the business energy tax credit, the BETC credit. It limits the total annual repower and retrofit credits to $3 million and sunsets the credits on December 31st, 2017. And with respect to that $3 million limit, you have a Dash 6 amendment, which is just a clarification. There was some concern expressed by the Department of Revenue that they would be that the E version would require the Department of Revenue to track the $3 million. And what the B6 amendment does is just clarify that the Department of Environmental Quality tracks the $3 million and stops issuing certifications once they hit that mark. The bill also extends the existing tax credit for new low-emission truck engines for model years 2011, and it reduces the limit on those credits, annual credits, from $3 million to $500,000.
Questions for Chris? Senator Monroe.
Does this apply to school buses as well, or just trucks?
Well, it's the diesel engines. The schools are allowed to benefit from it. The credits can be transferred. And so the school buses would be allowed to benefit from it. I mean, obviously, they don't pay taxes, so they don't benefit directly from the credit, but they can transfer the credit to another party.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. Andrew Ginsburg. Good morning. Bob Russell, Lindsay Capps.
Morning, Chair Deckard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsburg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm here today to urge your support for House Bill 2172B, which is a cornerstone of the Oregon Clean Air Initiative and also a priority for the governor. The bill would create incentives, including tax credits, as you just heard, for heavy-duty diesel engine owners to invest in clean diesel technology and it would enable Oregon to more successfully compete for federal funds for clean diesel. The bill comes to you from the House, where it passed on a vote of 57-0. Diesel engines move about 94% of the freight in the United States, and they're very important to Oregon's economy. Nothing rivals their power, their durability, their efficiency, their reliability. And they move everything from trucks to trains to ships. They power generators. They power construction and logging equipment, so they're very critical to the economy. However, diesel engine exhaust is linked to a number of problems, including cancer and cardiovascular disease, haze, global warming, and asthma. And diesel exhaust ranks among the top air toxics in Oregon, exceeding health benchmarks in 25 of Oregon's 36 counties. Overall, Oregonians have a risk of cancer from diesel exhaust that's roughly 13 times over public health benchmarks. So they're very important to our economy, but the exhaust is something we need to deal with. And the good news is the technology is now readily available to address this problem, making it possible for diesel engines to be as clean as compressed natural gas engines. Starting this year, the federal government is requiring this new technology on all new trucks and buses. And starting in 2010, the standards will apply to construction equipment and other non-highway engines. And now EPA is currently developing a regulation that would apply these standards to trains and marine engines. So in the long run, the new engines are going to be coming out much cleaner. The problem is that the existing engines are so durable that they'll last for another 30 years or more, and the benefits will come very slowly. So the purpose of House Bill 2172 is to accelerate the benefits and bring them here to Oregon sooner rather than later. Just really briefly, Section 2 of the bill establishes a goal to meet health benchmarks in 10 years and also to reduce risk to school children in 5 years. Sections 3 and 4, to address Senator Monroe's question, would enable school districts, Oregon school districts, to compete more successfully for federal grants that are available to clean up school buses. Sections 7 through 11 would establish a clean diesel fund to provide grants for retrofitting, repowering, scrapping, and reducing idling from diesel engines, including trucks and buses, and also non-road engines. And DEQ's budget bill includes $1 million of general fund along with $500,000 of highway funds that are dedicated to the Clean Diesel Fund for this purpose. The governor's recommended budget included $3 million of general fund for clean diesel. Sections 12 through 16 would establish a companion tax credit, which would cover 50% of the qualifying costs of retrofits and 25% of the qualifying costs for repowers. This tax credit would create a powerful incentive for engine owners to invest their own money to reduce emissions, and it would also help Oregon businesses compete for federal grants by increasing the amount of match they can provide. The tax credit, as you heard, would also be available to local governments and school districts and transit agencies that operate diesel engines, because they could pass through the credit to tax-paying entities.
Can you, Andy, just walk us through the mechanics of the tax credit in terms of I'm one of Bob's companies, or I'm the Philomena School District?
Yes, Mr. Chair. After making the expenditure, the entity would apply to DEQ for a certificate, and after identifying the qualifying costs for the tax credit that qualify for the tax credit, DEQ would issue the certificate, and then that could be used up to the taxpayer's liability, or up to 50% of their if they have multiple tax credits, up to 50% of their tax liability against that year's taxes, or it could be carried forward for, I believe, 2 years after that if they couldn't use it all in 1 year. If they're a non-taxpaying entity, then they could transfer the tax credit to a taxpaying entity for financial remuneration, and then both parties would benefit.
Just a couple questions on that. So the rationale for the 2 year carry forward, and I guess equivalent question, the rationale for the transferability of the credit.
Mr. Chair, the rationale for the carry forward would be that especially in some of the, and maybe Bob would want to answer this as well, but some of the entities that will be We're hoping that we'll retrofit their engines are marginally profitable, and expenditures for retrofitting their diesel engines don't provide any direct benefit for their businesses. They're done for the benefit of public health. And so if they're unable to utilize the whole tax credit in 1 year, this allows them to at least get the benefit over several years. The importance of the pass-through is that we have a number of public school districts and local governments, transit agencies that operate many diesel engines, and this is an important mechanism to enable them to get the benefit of the tax credit. And it's a theory that's been proven pretty well in the Betsy and the Retsy.
And I guess what's the second part of that would be, carrot or stick? I remember someone in this session said, well, why don't we just mandate, if it's a public health issue, why don't we just mandate cleaner engines? And
Mr. Chair, the mandate comes for the new engines. When an owner purchases a new engine, they're going to be investing quite a bit more for the new technology the EPA has required on all new engines. The existing engines met the standards that they were required to meet at the time they were sold, and so mandating the retrofit at this time is sort of a double whammy for the engine owner. Many states around the country are going down the path that we're going, which is to provide incentives and encourage for the existing engines to provide incentives rather than hammers. Some states, California, are beginning down the path of hammers and mandating that certain engines be replaced. There are a lot of questions that have to get worked out besides the impact on the businesses, including interstate commerce issues and and other legal questions that have arisen. So if we go down that path, it's not timely, and we really think we can get a lot of benefit going down an incentive approach here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Berg.
What about some kind of middle ground of maybe a mandate for a certain level of retrofit and then the incentive to go above and beyond?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think that any type of combination of that is possible, but the levels that you would set for the retrofits are there aren't really a continuing level of technologies. There are a couple of different technologies, some that are the most effective and most cost effective to be applied, and others that are that provide some benefit but aren't the most cost effective. So we really were encouraging engine owners to go to the best technology. So mandating something less than that would really not necessarily move us down the path we want to go to.
Or alternatively, and I think that makes sense, have the mandate but allow the credit within that structure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the bill actually does that. We require in the bill that the most cost-effective technologies be used, and there are a number of places that ensure that if someone is going to get a credit, that they are doing the most cost-effective technology, that they're maintaining it and getting the full benefit out of it.
Senator George.
Probably more like a statement than a question, but I want to ask you guys a comment on it. There's a natural exchange occurring in the fleets. Normally, the older trucks end up on the farms. We call it they come to the farm to retire. Those trucks are dying and becoming something we're going to salvage, and we're bringing in engines like Series 60 Detroits. Some of the most efficient Cummins engines are out there now, all computerized. They're monitoring their own exhaust. There's two reasons for that. Number one, the older trucks are getting very old, and these trucks are better, and they're affordable. Because the big fleets are going to replace in order to get the efficiencies and all their requirements. So we're having a natural evolution of that fleet. The other thing that's happening is, of course, we're all running low sulfur, and now it's going to be ultra-low sulfur. And, of course, the reductions there are about 95%, if I remember right, of the pollution is just gone with that one action. And so what you're having is I think the incentives at the top end are a good idea, and particularly for, as I see in this, school districts, transit providers who have a lot of start and stop. I mean, there's nothing like that kind of pollution. And I would wish that we would move aggressively to time all the lights in Oregon so we don't have trucks stopping and starting all the time. We need to do something about that. And that's a major reduction in this process. So I looked at the bill. I thought that was very, very balanced. And I hope that we don't do too much to it. Any comment on that? Because am I understanding the evolution of the fleet?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association. We've been going through a process of updating our engines. We started in the 2004 model year, where we dramatically reduced the NOx. As Senator George said, last year we went to low sulfur diesel, which reduced particulate matters. This year we went to to particulate traps, which eliminates 95% of the particulates. In 2010, we go to another version of engine that again drops NOx. I'm told that that version of engine, the exhaust, will be cleaner than the air in downtown Portland, so I often joke that we're going to route the exhaust into the cab of the truck to make our drivers more healthy.
Pretty good job. I've heard a lot of bad ones, and that's actually pretty good.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
You know, I've said repeatedly in this committee and others that technology really is our friend. We have engines right now. Can you imagine in a closed building that you would have a diesel-powered forklift, and yet Toyota and other manufacturers are producing a forklift that has less emissions, literally describing cleaner air coming out of the engine than what was pulled in to ignite the fuel. So, you know, we're making tremendous progress in the environmental issue.
We're getting you guys way off, but Senator Monroe.
Yeah, a couple of points. They have to travel 75% or more in the state of Oregon. Seems to me that that would exempt an awful lot of long-haul truckers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, absolutely it will. The focus here is getting the biggest bang for the buck. So what we're trying to do is retrofit those vehicles that spend most of their time in Oregon so that Oregonians benefit. And one of the misconceptions about this bill is it's primarily focused on the trucking industry. Certainly the trucking industry is part of the issue here, but you also have a whole bunch of off-road diesels. They're on a different path in terms of cleaning those diesels up. Some of them would benefit, in fact, more from retrofits than truck engines would. So in a lot of cases, those off-road pieces of equipment, they spend all their time in Oregon, and they're burning diesel all the time, and so it makes more sense to retrofit those first rather than the trucks that are spending a small amount of time in Oregon and traveling all over the country. It seems to us that it makes more sense for Oregon to spend money to benefit Oregonians than to spend money to benefit people in other states.
Okay, a couple others. I thought we saw a bill earlier in the session that had to do with allowing trucks to carry additional weight if they had these devices that heat the engine so that they don't have to have them idling for hours.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, yes. Matter of fact, out of Safety Lou, the most current version of the highway authorization bill, there was a provision that allowed a 400-pound weight allowance for auxiliary power units, or APUs, so that you can reduce the emissions when the truck is not actually traveling on the highway. It could be parked in order to keep the driver comfortable, because that, after all, that's the driver's home. Then you go to an auxiliary power unit. The auxiliary power units sort of range. Some of them have a small diesel engine, which is much less polluting than the large one, to purely battery powered. So that 400-pound weight allowance, and it's up to 400 pounds, it's the actual weight of the APU, was part of federal legislation. We adopted that through a bill earlier this session. You're correct.
Okay. And one final. Some school districts contract out to bus companies like Laidlaw to haul their kids. Are those tax exempt, or how would they work under this law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I don't know if they're tax-exempt or not, but either way they would be able to benefit from the law. If they are tax-paying entities, they could qualify for the tax credit directly. If not, they could apply for the pass-through. In addition, the grant program could work for them as well, so they would definitely be covered.
Thank you.
Just wrapping up on my testimony, there's one more provision of the bill. Section 17 through 22 would encourage the replacement of older diesel engines with clean new engines by extending the sunset date for the new truck engine tax credit to 2011. So this is an existing tax credit for new trucks, and it was first put into place in 2003. To provide encouragement for owners to purchase the new cleaner trucks that were coming out then in 2004. Now, as you heard Bob Russell say, in 2007 we have even cleaner, much, much cleaner trucks. In 2010 we'll have yet another generation of cleaner trucks. There's a concern that owners will delay purchasing the new trucks, wanting to not be the first one to a new model year and things like that. So continuing this tax credit is pretty important in encouraging that turnover that ultimately results in a cleaner truck making it to the farm. The House Revenue Committee made several amendments of interest to this committee. The amendments cap the tax credit for the existing engines at $3 million per year and lower the cap for the new engine tax credit from $3 million to $500,000 per year, so adding caps to the tax credits. They also added a sunset date of 2017 for the existing engine tax credit, and they clarified some of the language for implementing and enforcing the program. As staff said, we have Dash 6 amendment before you that was requested by the Department of Revenue to clarify how we will track the cap to ensure that we don't go over the $3 million, and essentially it requires DEQ not to issue more than $3 million of certificates per year, which is a much more efficient way of doing it than what's currently in the bill. So in summary, House Bill 2172B would provide significant public health and environmental benefits, and along with associated health and health care benefits, by creating a package of grants, tax credits, loans to reduce diesel engines. I'd be happy to answer any further questions you have.
Great. Thank you, Andy. On the certificates, this is more a mechanics question. You know by the engine that do you need to inspect it? Does DEQ have to go out and inspect it? Or you know when they send in the receipt from Senator Charles probably knows the company that manufactures the Detroit 60. I can't believe I got that right. But you know that you just issue the certificate that is...
And Mr. Chair, by rule, we'll be establishing those procedures, but there are known technologies that work on different engine families, and those will be the ones that will be allowed. And if people have others that don't fit the standard process, then they'll have to provide more documentation.
And one of the things that we are battling is our colleagues are not as interested in tax credits this session in general. And as we run lists out to the broader legislative audience, the response hasn't been, it's just a numbers issue. On this one, I think the natural question might be, how big of an impact, given the small nature of the tax, or relatively not a huge tax credit there, how by percentage are you making an impact on the number of vehicles that are out there on the highways, given that it's capped tax credit?
Mr. Chair, we've established a goal in Section 2 of the bill of reducing health risk to the benchmarks in 10 years, and that's going to be achieved through a combination of the tax credit, the grant program, private investment, the new engine standards that EPA is establishing, and also pretty substantial federal grants that are available. And that's part of the key to the answer to your question, is that we need to bring more of those federal grants to Oregon, and many of those grants you compete better if you can put local match on the table. They don't necessarily have an automatic mandatory match requirement, but if you are showing that you're applying for these federal grants in the context of having a state program, putting some local money on the table, you're much more likely to be successful. And that's the key to our calculation. We need the tax credit to enable private business to put more of their own funds into the program to increase our overall match and bring more of those federal dollars. So that all fits together in a puzzle to get us to our goal.
Bob and Lindsay, we haven't even heard from, kind of just jumped right in. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations again. In light of all the questions, I'm just going to make a few very quick points about this particular bill. There's some things that we really like about this bill a lot. One of them is the cost-benefit ratio approach that this will take. And as Andy said, there's a number of different ways that we can attract additional money to this program. For example, if a private entity brings match, that moves them up in the selection process. So we're trying to leverage the few Oregon dollars that we have in here as much as possible. We can also apply for federal funds. There's a whole bunch of different things that we can do to make this program more effective with a small investment that's actually in this bill. The second thing is the service delivery method, which I think is really important here. We're going to leverage the existing providers of engines and engine technologies. For example, Cummins, we were talking about earlier. We worked with them in setting up this bill. They will actually work with the people that own the diesel engines, whether it be a construction company, a trucking company, a school bus fleet, or whatever. And they will do an analysis. They will take that to DEQ. DEQ will give prior approval. Once that happens, then the provider of the technology brings in the vehicles or the equipment. They install the retrofits. Then they, in fact, build the EQ for whatever the residual is, and we go on our way. So we're really leveraging the private sector sales force that's already in existence, that's working with us every day, and other engine owners to make this bill more effective. So those two things are really key, I think, to the success of the approach that we have here. When we were in the House, we had a work group to work over the tax credit piece with Representative Butler and Representative Reed. So there were significant changes that were made in the House at that time. As Andy mentioned, so far we have not had a single no vote on this particular bill. And the coalition that's supporting this bill is very broad. We're just a very small subset in the interest of your time. But there are lots of folks. Matter of fact, I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill at all.
Who's that? Senator George.
Oh, go ahead.
Who's had in on the work group in the House other than the two representatives?
Mr. Chair, Chris was also part of it. The Department of Revenue, Deborah Buchanan was part of it. Myself, Andy, I'm not sure Lindsay didn't come. No. But it was basically looking at the technical piece to the revenue stuff.
Yeah, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I look at the numbers and I think, oh, man, this is not adequate. And, Bob, I'm going to ask you if you know anything about this. And I'm talking to the test driver for Mercedes, well, actually for Freightliner that was driving the new Mercedes powered truck. He told me that the engine does a whole bunch of things that were pretty amazing. But one of the things was is the cost of that engine,
right.
Amazing cost. As compared to, you know, your off-the-shelf Cummins or Detroit. But the other thing was is the change-out rate that they're looking at, which would be similar to Japan. In other words, you get not too many miles on there, and all of a sudden that engine's coming out and another one's going back in. What is the trend that you're hearing right now towards that kind of Japanese-like operation?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the new engines are very much more expensive. They're $10,000 more than the previous version of engines. They're averaging about $35,000 a copy. When I was originally in the trucking business back in the 70s, you could buy a new engine between $8,000 and $10,000. Now it's $35,000, and a lot of it is the environmental equipment that's on the engine that's made it much more complex. So, yes, they are a whole lot more expensive. You know, we're still testing these new engines, and, you know, I would
submit to you that, that it's different than the Japanese experience. I mean, we've got Cummins, Detroit, Caterpillar that have been engineering these for a number of years. We don't know if the life is going to be shorter of these new engines or not. The fuel mileage has dropped slightly. With the new version of the engines, we're certainly aware of that. The maintenance is increased because you've got to deal with a particulate trap. It's got some interesting features to it. One of the things that the particulate trap does is it actually goes through a regeneration cycle, and you pump raw diesel into it, and then you ignite it. And you've got temperatures up to 1,500 degrees in that particulate trap while you're regenerating it and burning out the particulates. So that's been an interesting addition to the trucking industry, is dealing with those kinds of temperatures. So we don't know everything there is to know about the new engines. We do know that they cost more, but we also know that they reduce emissions substantially.
Mr. Chairman, that was perfect to describe my point, and that is we may have to make a substantial investment in order to take us to the next level of clean air.
Sounds like a scene from The Sopranos last night. how did that, well, I'll get that offline, how the car exploded.
You mean the 1,400 degrees? Yeah, I told Bob, please don't put that thing hauling fuel.
Lindsay. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, Lindsay Capps with the Oregon Environmental Council. We strongly support this legislation, and as Bob mentioned, there's a broad coalition in support of this. American Lung Association, AFSCME, the Oregon Asthma Program, the Learning Disabilities Association, the Oregon Center for Environmental Health, and Physicians for Social Responsibility. We think this is a really cost-effective way to get at a tough public health and environmental problem in this state. Diesel is, I believe, the number one air toxic in the state. It's been linked to lung cancer, upper respiratory illness, asthma, and even death from heart and lung disease. You know, there are 40 air toxics that are released when diesel is burned. Many of these are carcinogenic, and a number of studies have also linked diesel exhaust to low birth weight, premature births, and increased risk of birth defects. And diesel soot is of particular concern in terms of childhood asthma. It's an asthma trigger, and I think currently today there are about 58,000 children in the state that suffer from asthma, and about 333,000 Oregonians in total that suffer from asthma, and that number is on the rise. We obviously are concerned about the fact that diesel exhaust or that several states or counties in the state do not meet basic health benchmarks for diesel exhaust. And even in those counties that do, there's still concentrated sources around highways and construction sites that make diesel a real public health problem. And that harms both our health and our pocketbooks. Examples of costs that are borne by everyone in Oregon are rising health insurance costs, cost to employers, and cost to taxpayers associated with respiratory and cardiovascular hospitalizations, lost work days, and premature deaths triggered by diesel pollution. In Washington state, they've estimated that for just asthma alone, the annual cost in terms of public health and environment is about $50 million a year. So when you look at this program, currently I think about $3 million called for in the governor's budget. I think to meet the benchmark that's been set out in the bill, you need about $14 million. You know, that's really a cost-effective approach to take in dealing with, I guess, what is overall about $2 billion a year in public health and environmental costs. So we urge your support for the bill and hope for its speedy passage.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, a couple of questions. I think I read a study somewhere along the Minnesota Freeway, which I guess is I-5 north through north and northeast Portland, that the rate of asthma among children in that corridor is significantly higher than the rest of the city.
I believe that's correct. I know we did a study about 10 years ago in the Albina neighborhood and found that this is a neighborhood in North Portland, and found that although this neighborhood had about 13% of Multnomah County's population, it had somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of the diesel emissions, and that was a lot of that coming from I-5 and from surrounding industrial areas. So it is a real problem.
Second follow-up,
please.
I was in Europe a couple of years ago, and the vast majority of passenger cars in Europe now are diesel. Are they having these kinds of problems because of that, or do they have they all adopted the cleaner diesel standards?
I'm actually not sure on that. I'm not familiar with Europe and diesel. Andy might be able to answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, first, I know you know this, but just to clarify, our bill is about heavy-duty diesel engines and your question about passenger vehicles. They do have the diesel passenger vehicles currently do have much higher emissions than the gasoline-powered vehicles, but they will be, within a few years, they'll be coming up to the same standards that are met by gasoline-powered vehicles. So they currently do have a little problem with that in Europe, but we'll be addressing that too.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just leave you with one more thought. I do appreciate your comment about tax credits and the concerns about them. Just to distinguish this particular tax credit, that it is focused on only going above and beyond what's required by law. It's very much focused on cost effectiveness, and by being part of an overall program, including the grants and the federal tax, we think we're really leveraging the relatively small investment and tax credits that we're putting in to bring a much larger benefit to Oregon. And evidence of the wide support of 57-0 vote in the House, I think this is one of those tax credits where people feel that it's an appropriate use of state revenues. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just a couple of quick questions. The general comment on tax credits, they tend to pass unanimously once they make it to the floor. The pushback that we're getting, and folks should know it if you're hoping to get a tax credit, is just that they have general fund implications, obviously, and there's just a give and take, and folks have to shift priorities within the budget to buy these tax credits, whether it's this one or the myriad of others. And so that's just the anyone that's concerned or wants one, I would be out there pressing, obviously, folks on this committee, but then a broader audience, so that they make it to the Senate floor in this case. The 2017 sunset, that's longer than we're used to seeing on a...
Mr. Chair, we set that date to coincide with the 10-year goal in the Section 2 of the bill, which is to achieve the health benefits by 2017. Our intent is to keep working at this every biennium and make continuing progress, and then when we hit the goal, to eliminate the tax credit. So if we were to sunset it earlier, it wouldn't really line up with our timeline and our goal.
We might want to, if this is, and it'd probably come in a different bill, because we'll probably combine whatever tax credits do occur into one bill. We may want to revisit that, especially with the care for it and the transferability. It allows someone, even 6 years or seven years out, to carry forward to that 10-year, understanding that you don't get the, you can't claim it in year nine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Krupp, and that is it on 2172.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief. I know that you have floor session here. For the record, I'm Jeff Krupp, Director of the Northwest Renewable Fuels Association. We strongly support the direction of this bill because we believe that the ultimate outcome will be a greater need for renewable fuels, specifically biodiesel produced locally right here in Oregon with all the ensuing benefits of it. And I have to say, as both a fifth-generation farmer and a guy who drives a 94 Ford diesel pickup with 283,000 miles on it, that when I burn biodiesel in both farm equipment and my diesel pickup with all the mileage, there's a noticeably less amount of pollution that comes out of the tailpipe. And I think that issue, creating a stronger renewable fuels industry in Oregon, specifically biodiesel, will help with some of the issues that have been discussed here today, such as older engines, both on the farm and out on the road, that have visibly higher levels of pollution. Biodiesel can help resolve that issue, Mr. Chairman, and we urge support of the bill.
So this, folks, should take note. Lobbying for a different bill in this bill, that is talent unlike you are used to seeing, working in a different bill into that bill. That is talent, very
very persuasive. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2172. Chris, do you have Betsy Retzi? Okay. Unless folks object, let's just do Betsy and Retzi together. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2211 and a public hearing on 2212.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2211 modifies the Betsy credit. It makes a number of changes. First, it increases the amount of the credit for renewable energy from 35% to 50%, taken over 10 years, so that would be 10% in each year. It provides a credit to home builders for installing renewable energy systems in homes and for designing and building high-performance, low-energy homes. It allows Betsy and any federal energy tax credit to be used for the same energy-efficient or renewable energy project. It provides that alternative fuel facilities, combined heat and power facilities, and renewable energy manufacturing facilities qualify for the 50% tax credit. The bill increases the size of hydro facility eligible for Betsy from 1 megawatt to 10 megawatts, provided that the facility meets all statutory requirements for protection of fish and wildlife. It increases the maximum amount of costs eligible for the tax credit from $10 million to $20 million per project for renewable energy resources, including all the alternative fuels, renewable energy manufacturing facilities, or combined heat and power projects, and it places a sunset date of January 1, 2016 on the Betsy credit. 2212 makes some modifications to the RETSI credit, the Residential Energy Tax Credit. It increases the maximum tax credit for fuel cells and for wind generation from $1,500 to $6,000, claimed over 4 years, and clarifies that the tax credit may be taken for each qualifying device if more than one device is acquired in the same year. Current law is only one device per taxpayer is used. This would allow multiple. And it also makes high-efficiency wood stoves eligible for the RETSI credit.
Thank you, Chris. Questions for Mr. Onuk? Okay, we have two people who've traveled more than 100 miles and were under a call trying to get excuse from it. So maybe I'll have Mike. Mike, can you come up and just kind of lead off with that? And then we'll try to work in our folks who've traveled a distance first just to make sure we get them. And we're hoping to not have to leave, but we could get called to the floor, which usually means we walk out there and walk right back here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I'm Mike Rainey, Director of the Department of Energy, and with me is Bill Nesmith, Assistant Director in charge of our tax credit and conservation programs. Let me just make a few remarks beyond what Chris covered on both bills. I think he highlighted the main points in terms of the what the bills do. These two changes, or these two bills, will substantially increase the incentives for renewable energy, especially House Bill 2211, the Business Energy Tax Credit. And it's a key part of the incentives for the biofuel industry that we hope to develop as well, because it will help the capital costs for the biofuel production facilities. The tax credits, both tax credits are in the governor's budget. As Chris mentioned, there's a sunset now on the business energy tax credit in 2211. And it's the same one that this committee put on the residential tax credit last session. We also have developed metrics for benchmarks for both programs to show the effectiveness of them in the House Revenue Committee before the House passed those bills. And we have copies of both those metrics and the section summaries for them. I think the only other thing on 2211 I wanted to mention, there's a section 5A, that's been of some interest to a number of people, and that makes a technical change for the regarding the transfer of the business tax credit. And it's changed so that investor-owned utilities can continue to participate as pass-through partners in the tax credit program. And this section clarifies that a tax credit transferred under 469-206 doesn't reduce the amount of taxes required to be reported by the investor-owned utility. And this is a clarification as a result of Senate Bill 408 passed last session. It does not change Senate Bill 408, and it only applies to tax credits that the utilities acquire through the pass-through payment or receiving the tax credit from others, such as schools and local governments that can't use the value of the tax credit. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Torch.
These credits for very efficient energy use of homes includes mobile home manufacturers that might be able to add the kind of insulation as special products. Correct. Would they be able to suggest that, you know, here's option A, and if you do this, you get a tax credit with your new mobile home?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, for the record, my name is Bill Nesmith, Assistant Director at Oregon Department of Energy, and there is a provision in the 2211 that talks about constructing, making this available for home projects working with home builders. I believe there's no reason a manufactured housing project couldn't also qualify. Benefit and qualify for that.
That's a section 8 that I was looking at. Thanks.
Mike, I did a dreadful job explaining the benefits of BETC to a few or a larger group of my colleagues and why it's a valuable tax credit. Can you, in three sentences, tell us that, and maybe in a few more, just the mechanics of I'm a looking at a project and how BETC would help?
Yes, it can help everything from lighting, hot water heating, space heating, industrial processes, and you know, in three sentences, we've had over $900 million of investment by businesses in energy efficiency and renewable energy with the help of the tax credit program over the years. And those projects are saving $300 million a year in reduced energy costs. So it makes a real difference to the businesses and schools and nonprofit institutions that can use the tax credit with the pass-through mechanism.
Senator George.
When we build our financial costs, you know, this is what this bill will cost in the sense of lost revenue. When you think about industry and business saving, you know, $300 million, that's going to show up on somebody's profit statement. And I think we're going to get it back. And the cost of installation and all those employees that are working on these projects, you know, to put these facilities in place, to me, I think our revenue will end up being positive on this. And in the long term, we know we need to do this. I mean, there is just a limited amount of energy on the face of the earth. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, that's correct. We do score the estimated revenue impact because we know you have to treat tax credits that way, but we definitely believe, and we've done studies that show the economic benefits of both tax credit programs that clearly produce increased revenues for the state and increased incomes.
Thank you.
Echo Northwest did the study.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
They do all the studies. They have a monopoly on. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, Mike Noonan, Mr. Noonan, you've come from a distance, Klamath Falls area, I believe. And Mr. Wooden? I'm not sure. I could take a guess. Where you travel from. Mr. Noonan.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mike Noonan. I'm from Klamath Falls, Oregon. I farm a farm down there, and I've been coming up here every once in a while, but I'll gladly let you know I got things planted in between times, so that's a good thing. But I've been coming here because it's very important to us as a wheat growers to take part in renewable energy here at the state level. You know, it's our view that there is a limited resource of energy, and with the political sense that we're going to move at with renewables, we'd like to take part. With that being said, the tax credit for producing, storing, and on-farm manufacturing will turn into dollars back to the state. First, we got to get started, though. And to get started, this tax credit is much needed. One of the biggest things I can see is cellulosic energy and, you know, needing to keep it dry, that's going to take barns. And increased storage for grain, that all costs a lot of money. But regional fuel, you know, for from a personal standpoint, regional fuel may be where this is going. You know, maybe there's a plant in Klamath Falls someday. Maybe, and the end result is, or LaGrande, or maybe Portland, Willamette Valley, wherever it might be, regional fuel will bring down, make us competitive when we're buying fuel in the future. And that's one of the big things we can see. So we're ready to take part, and we're in favor of it.
Thank you. I don't see John Charles here, but he was earlier. So John Charles with Cascade, he might say, tends to on these, government ought not be involved. The market will take care of. So y'all folks in government, don't worry about this. The market at some level will help out the Mr. Mike Noonans of the world, and there will be an incentive there. It might not happen on your timetable, but it will happen. Any response from your perspective of on the ground, owner of a farm, having to make these decisions, and then how the Betsy tax credit, you would use it?
Well, you know, on the biggest thing for us is fuel and fertilizer costs. And one of our biggest fears moving in 25 by 25 is the fact that we're going to have a 25% mandate and we're not going to be producing this stuff. So that means we got to bring it. From what we see, what I do on our farm is I'm running a canola trial right now. I did one last year with Oregon State. We're seeing if that works. Very interesting, cellulosic too. Taking the straw byproduct for irrigated, so we got so much straw that you can't even work it into the ground. So usually we'll bale off half of it and incorporate the other half for nutrient retention in the ground. But so what we'll do is look at those two different avenues, and canola has a place, I think, in Klamath, and so does the possibility of high sugared grains that can compete with corn. That can all be possible, but you have to get started. To create that infrastructure, to put in that on-farm small canola plant, to do that kind of stuff and take the byproduct, and then make diesel, well, that's going to take a significant investment, and quite frankly, it won't be made without some kind of incentive. You know, I mean, I won't be able to take that kind of risk. There's risk within the markets. Plus, I'll just hit on this real quickly. Research dollars to find out how we best compete within the state of Oregon is going to be very key in the next 4 to 5 years, whether it be cellulosic or high energy grains, whatever it might be.
Huh. That's good to know. Just the basic research that we do at our universities.
Yeah, I think what we're going to find is, back to Eisen, actually went to D.C. last week, and we're talking a lot about renewable energies. And the feeling I get, and I got limited knowledge, but I do know one thing: farmers will embrace and take on whatever challenge that is profitable. And to get the jump start, we need the tax credit. Well, but it's really coming down to a regional type issue, you know. For Oregon, how are we going to produce our own feedstock? There's going to be competition for this feedstock for ethanol production, just for keeping things and biofuels, just to keep our air clean. I mean, there's an environment, and then on top of it, as we get into that market, we're going to be competing for those feedstocks just to compete. If we're not growing them here, and we don't make the investment now, 5 years from now, we'll be so far behind it won't matter.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Whitten.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Whitten. I'm Executive Director of Community Renewable Energy Association. We're a new intergovernmental Chapter 190 nonprofit with membership comprising a number of Oregon counties, government and nonprofit organizations, and private industries that support locally owned community renewables in Oregon. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2211. The future of renewable energy in Oregon looks very promising with the signing last week of Senate Bill 838 and the positive amendments being discussed today, with in particular to Betsy as proposed by 2211. A portion of the bill seeks to modify Betsy as part of an ongoing program of aligning various state programs with the evolving policy supporting community renewable projects. Currently, community renewable projects of up in the range of 10 megawatts can cost $15 to $20 million, and part of the realignment in 2211 is to move the cap for Betsy from the existing $10 million to $20 million to recognize the cost of these community projects. Also, increasing the tax credit from 35% to 50% of project costs is intended to help attract more investment dollars into the pool in anticipation of the number of projects that will likely be coming out of the movement toward renewable energy standard. Betsy does a lot to help support the financing of locally owned community projects like wave energy, solar, small hydro, biomass, community wind, and geothermal. As these projects come online, they provide, well, as Senator George mentioned, they provide well-needed jobs and economic development for rural Oregon and help to support the Oregon's renewable energy standard. In conclusion, I'd like to thank you for the support we've shown so far in this legislative session for renewables, and I encourage you to continue that trend by supporting 2211. And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to Capitol. Mark Nelson, Doug Riggs, it seems like y'all are together. At least you have the lines attached to you two. Whether you like it or not.
Mr.
Senator George.
While they're coming up, could I ask a question? And the question is this. The House has moved these, and it's almost unanimous votes. Are they looking at a different set of numbers than we are? Because I think these are great ideas, and I'd love to move them. Are we dealing with the same amount of total credits limitation?
It's a good question. Good question. The way we've structured it is the House... the reason the Senate hasn't moved any tax credits in the House, before we really set it on a level that we would do short-term, medium-term, and long-term, decided to get them over here so that we could work them. So that was the conscious decision that happened probably April or May. And then we're holding them, hearing them, looking at them, and then trying to do those final negotiations on what is available in the budget. If you look at the March budget that was put out, only $9 million, which we've heard more than $9 million in tax credits probably this morning, and certainly in the last week we've heard probably $20 or $30 million, but only $9 million was allocated in the budget for the session.
Mr. Chairman,
it's a good lead-in.
I had moved my name down to the bottom because I was waiting for an amendment from Legislative Council.
Oh.
Hook up with Mr. Riggs
here. So you pointed, yeah, so on the sheet it points right at Doug Riggs. We'll put you near the top, Doug, so that you could, well, then let's just keep, we'll just stay in order then. Thanks, Mark, for the explanation of that. Jeff Hildebrand, Scott Bolton, and then why don't we do Tom Gallagher so we have kind of the utility perspective together. But Jeff, if you're here, feel free to join our utilities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher representing PGE, and we'd like to go after Mark Nelson.
Okay, let's keep this trend going. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, we're here to talk about Section 5A, not the whole bill. We're very supportive of the whole bill. And I'd just like to walk you through the utility position in Section 5A, which is allowing us to use the Betsy credits, notwithstanding a bill last year, 2 years ago, that I didn't work on, Senate Bill 408, which I'm surprised to find somewhat controversial. Mm-hmm. Section 5A, when PUC was working through the rules on 408, they said that Betsy tax credits could be passed through by affiliates. And PG right now is a standalone, isn't an affiliate, so the language isn't on all fours with where we want to go. 408 is very controversial over at the PUC. We're very nervous about buying tax credits and then going over to the PUC and hoping they clarify their ruling. So we came down here in this bill, 2011, to clarify that issue of pass-throughs. And pass-throughs is where we buy tax credits from somebody else at a discounted rate and use them on our taxes. The language in 469.185 is not the same as the language in the PUC decision. So there's two reasons why we want to do something here in this bill. If you look at Section 45, it allows us to take a tax credit, and I'm reading from line 2 in Section 5A. The owner of a facility may transfer a tax credit for the facility. Now, one of the questions that's been raised is how broad are these tax credits we're passing through since we're dealing with electrical utilities. If you turn back in the bill to page 4, you'll see the definition of facility. So these are what we're going to use the tax credits. These are the kinds of tax credits that are going to be passed through for us for energy facility, recycling facility, transportation facility, car sharing, substantial building practices. There are a number of things that promote conservation and renewable resources. And they're coming from not-for-profits and other groups of people that can't use these tax credits. A good example are TriMet bus passes. And TriMet has the Portland area has a congestion pricing. Mode splitting to force to get large employers to move people into buses and so forth. And these bus passes are the major ways in which a lot of companies like Schnitzer and others that aren't on major transportation routes, they buy these tax credits and so forth. And PGE does the same thing. So we use these to encourage the other employers to provide bus passes to their folks, and then we'll use the tax credits if they can't, and reduces the emissions and reduces the energy that's used, et cetera, in the Portland area. So that's why Section 5A is there. It's not a rollback of 408. We believe that when you did 408 last time, you wanted to continue to allow utilities to use these tax credits for those purposes of Betsy's. And secondly, and the last thing I'll say on that is, these tax credits are purchased with below-the-line dollars. These are not dollars that are used for the operation of the utility. They're the shareholders' rate of return dollars. And so it makes sense to us to clarify the PUC rule and to allow us to continue to purchase these Betsy tax credits. If you don't pass this, frankly, it's too risky for us to do it. And there would just be a gap in a number of people who then will buy them because they can't use them themselves. Thank you.
So, Tom, Senator George.
Just to clarify this, if someone's putting in an alternative energy unit that would, in fact, qualify under the bill, they may not have the income at this time. They turn around and sell them to you at a discounted rate, but that's revenue to them to keep their installation construction moving. Is that a correct analysis of...
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair George, that's absolutely it. You have to have some people out there that have a cash flow to be able to purchase the credits, number one. And number two, have the public policy will to do it. I mean, these are things that we generally are encouraged by our ratepayers to participate in, and by the community we live in to participate in.
Tom, the one, Scott, you may get to this. I assume, since I've heard very little about Section 5, Sub 3, that this was vetted with the PUC and the customer groups, and everyone just nodded to this. The fact that I believe any of us on the 408 issue would indicate that that's the case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's been vetted and re-vetted by lots of folks, but I can say in all honesty that the industrial customers and the utilities never came to an absolute conclusion on this. They've always sort of kept their, well, I'm not sure, we're not comfortable. And we were unable in many meetings to exactly work out language with them. It's my understanding they're going to bring in language that talks about limiting it to energy uses and conservation uses. And generally, I'd say, yeah, that's what we're going to do with it. But that's what I think this definition section already does. And what's at issue are some of these transportation facility uses, like the bus passes.
Great. Mr. Bolton. Yeah. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, I'm Scott Bolton with Pacific Corp. I'll just say in very broad terms, as far as Section 5A and Senate Bill 408 goes, I don't believe it was ever contemplated limiting the use of the Betsy credit to utilities as a pass-through partner. The reason the language is included, as Mr. Gallagher just mentioned, is that there was some uncertainty over the pass-through provision. I think most folks, even including the industrial customers, agreed that if a utility itself is using the Betsy, which we do to help with above-market costs with some of our renewable energy facilities, for instance, as a direct investment in the utility's operations, that made sense and that the bill wasn't intended to limit our ability to apply that credit for our own customers' benefit. The question really became, well, if we're a pass-through partner and we're purchasing credits from somebody else's renewable energy or conservation or recycling activities, does that put the utility at some risk under Senate Bill 408? And that's really what brought us here today with this language. That's the question, that's the policy question that the legislature has been asked to clarify this session, and it has been through testimony and through vetting through the House Committee and also through the Senate Energy and Environment Committee, where Senator Abaki and Senator Atkinson did speak to this specific provision as well. That there's still concern over this is somewhat astonishing. Again, going back to the record of Senate Bill 408, it was never really anticipated that those types of partnerships that we would enter into with our customers, the industrial customer provisions of the, or uses of the Betsy, is a major part of that program. And we partner with our industrial customers often in buying pass-through credits when they don't have a tax liability or have, you know, other things going on where they need a partner for that kind of activity. And through folks in our communities that we serve, we've partnered with Albina Head Start, for instance, to work with them on when they've made a conservation investment in their facilities and then acting as a pass-through partner to monetize that investment. So, again, we don't think that this is a very controversial issue. It's one certainly that should have no burden on ratepayers, as Mr. Gallagher mentioned. Ratepayer dollars are not used to purchase these credits, nor are these credits reflected in rates. If we go out and go crazy buying a lot of Betsy credits, we're not going to build that into the next rate case. We're not going to increase our customers' rates as a result. So I anticipate that you'll see some amendments that will speak somewhat towards whether, you know, what kinds of uses of the Betsy utility should or shouldn't have. We'll come back and have that discussion when those are ready, but that's our view at least today on that. Great. Questions for our utilities? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, do you want to hold off if you're, I assume your amendments are on this issue. Do you want to hold off today then? Okay. Mr. Hildebrand? Okay, scratch Mr. Hildebrand from Washington. Jeremiah Ballman? Jeff Krupp, is it on this bill? Okay, Jeff Krupp.
Chair, I have to carry, I think, the second bill up.
So okay, so we only have a few minutes. We only have a few more folks. We only have two or three more. Jeremiah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Environment Oregon, the new home of Osberg's environmental work. I'll speak very briefly in support of both 2211 and 2212. Just a couple, a little bit of context and some specific provisions I'd like to point out. First, on one of the earlier questions, I do expect that it will come up, you know, why is the government subsidizing or making these kinds of choices in the energy marketplace? And my basic response on that is that you'll never find a market any less free than the energy market. It's one of the most heavily subsidized in all sorts of bizarre and counterproductive directions, but it's certainly in the direction of fossil fuels is probably the clearest direction that it's currently subsidized, primarily at the federal level. Furthermore, on the electricity side, we're in regulated monopolies, so there's not a whole lot of free market to solve these problems when it comes to energy. Another big picture point that I will just make is that a lot of people have already mentioned the relationship to Senate Bill 838. We do see House Bills 2211 and 2212 as a complement to that standard that was set out, both in terms of providing incentives that go along with some of the mandates and standards in Senate Bill 838, but it also, I think, will help implementation of Senate Bill 838 in a way that's very beneficial for Oregon. The two specific points I'll make are that, one, it's helpful for diversifying our energy as we move towards the goal of 25% renewable energy by 2025. There's a lot of conversation in the 838 context that right now wind is the most cost-effective renewable, so we're going to see a lot of wind development. These kinds of tax credits help make sure that other Oregon energy sources, wave energy, solar energy, geothermal energy, are also able to get out there and compete in that world, and that we get not only the diversity, but then that also means we get to be more homegrown and more local. For a whole set of reasons, the compliance with our 25% renewable energy standard won't all be Oregon energy. It'll be from all over the West. This, however, will encourage more of it to be local and more of it homegrown, which maximizes the benefits both for the economy and for the environment when we're not transmitting electricity for long distances. Let me close by just pointing out two provisions in this bill that I think have not gotten a lot of attention, but I think are important provisions. One is that it allows for home builders and developers to take tax credits currently available to homeowners. I think that's an important provision because there are a lot of renewable energy systems, particularly solar energy, that make more sense to be put in at the construction stage, both because then they can be rolled into the mortgage, which is better for the consumer, and because the construction itself is more cost-effective at that point. So that's a good incentive, I think, to have out there and to get some of these decisions made when the home is built, even before there isn't a owner of it. I'll also point out the high-performance home tax credit, which is a new use of the Betsy tax credit. This is a place where Oregon is really pioneering right now in these high-performance homes that are extraordinarily low energy-consuming homes that also generate their own energy. And so you hear about them talked about sometimes as net zero homes that over the course of a year end up with a net zero energy consumption. It's a place where Oregon's really pioneering now, and I think this is a good tool to try to broaden the use of that option by homeowners in a way that could really kind of be the next major shift, I think, in how we build our communities for energy conservation purposes. So I just wanted to highlight those two and voice our strong support for both bills.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator George.
A little concerned about the idea that the pass-through that the home builder would get would not pass through to the consumer. Are you expecting that consumer awareness will demand that, hey, I get some of that because I'm the one who's going to be on the line to pay for all of the new technology? And so I want to make sure we have the proper incentives for the home builder and also for the home buyer.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, that's an excellent point. We had a similar concern from a consumer protection perspective early on in the session. That's why you'll notice in that section of the bill there's a requirement that the home builder disclose to the prospective buyer that they've taken that tax credit. Okay. So there's an opportunity for fair negotiation there.
Good. Okay, thanks.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeff Krupp, Executive Director of the Northwest Renewable Fuels Association. Before I get started, and I'll go very quickly to be brief, I also want to state a potential conflict of interest because I am a fifth-generation Oregon farmer, and I will certainly benefit from the positive effects of House Bill 2211, which I want to confine my comments to today, and also because I'm an investor in not one, not two, but now three renewable fuels, biofuels companies. So I put my money where my mouth is on this issue. You have my handout before you. I want to quickly make these observations that I would ask you to consider. House Bill 2211 works today because the Business Energy Tax Credit works today. It is working, and we have some great examples of the success of that. It's a proper incentive, and we think that expanding the Business Energy Tax Credit, as House Bill 2211 does, specifically with renewable fuels, clearly helps us in many, many ways. Your bullet points articulate that it provides the incentive for private investment that creates that truly competitive local, and I emphasize local, fuels market. More competition means lower prices at the pump and better service for consumers. Plus, we obviously have cleaner air is a great benefit that I think we all want. We have less imported crude oil when we grow homegrown fuels, and obviously we create a lot of jobs in Oregon, and that's a good thing. I would ask you to consider the concept that tax incentives, and these are tax incentives that are front-loaded because they're temporary, They're front-loaded, and they pay off big down the road. And I think there's some great examples of that. I would maintain that they pay for themselves. And we're actually seeing that happen in Minnesota. Minnesota's ethanol industry this year will create in about 11,000 jobs alone. 1 billion gallons of ethanol produced in Minnesota, $3 billion of business activity, and they've shown that they're actually creating more money to the state treasury through the collection of taxes than what they're putting out. And by the way, to the regard and Senator Deckert's question previously about the free market, we maintain, and I would agree with Jeremiah, that there isn't a free market today, and I would think that that's evident to each one of us when we fill up our vehicles at the pump. Other states are competing right now through tax incentives for about $25 billion of private investment in renewable fuels facilities in America today. So if Oregon doesn't compete, we won't get all the benefits of renewable fuels productions here today in Oregon. Plus, I would also say that government is already heavily involved in the quote-unquote the fuels marketplace with the billions and billions of dollars that big oil gets in subsidies all across America. And across the world, for that matter. And I've detailed that for you in prior publications that I have left at your office. The expanded Betsy is an essential incentive that helps local investors decide to build the infrastructure that is going to be necessary. The Betsy helps ensure the success of local biofuels production. So when local farmers come together or local biomass collectors come together to build a facility that processes biomass or the grass seed straw that I burn in the air today, that the Betsy helps them because you can monetize it. Senator George, as you had mentioned earlier, you can sell this Betsy tax credit. Helps smaller companies, undercapitalized companies, be able to maintain a profitability factor that means they're going to be around years down the road, when the tax incentive is gone, by the way. And it's interesting to note, in that regard, Mr. Chairman, over 60% of the ethanol plants in Minnesota are owned by local farmer co-ops. And they remain local because they see the benefit to them directly, and so they're not selling out to big oil or anybody else. They're maintaining that ownership. We can create that here in Oregon, and that's what House Bill 2211 helps do it. Local production of renewable fuels means that when we're producing fuels, renewable fuels from local resources, we have a more stable fuel price. Because you have local production, that's that competitive model, and we're not subject to the great ups and downs of the volatile crude oil market. And I would hold up this little chart for you, Mr. Chairman. The bottom part of this chart here represents when these bills were introduced in the Oregon legislature this session, end of January, 1st of February. The high point of this chart, Mr. Chairman, is last month's high point of fuel prices. In the time that we've been discussing these bills, we've had a dollar increase in the price of fuel at the local retail pump price. The Betsy, the expanded Betsy, Mr. Chairman, will also help with new renewable fuels technologies, research and investment at the private level, the private investment level that we need in industries like cellulose, animal fat conversion, Mr. Chairman, hydrogen, Mr. Chairman, some other technologies that are out there. It also helps, by the way, companies that are here today. We have a great example of this in Salem, Mr. Chairman. We have a company called Sequential Biofuels. They produce biodiesel, the only biodiesel producer of any large magnitude. Well, I step back. There's another one now in Klamath Falls. They're planning to expand their facility to meet the growing need of biodiesel that we've talked about earlier today. The Betsy helps them do that. Pacific Ethanol, which is one of our members, is looking at new technologies for cellulose and other opportunities. They're also wanting to utilize the business energy tax credit. That helps them, as a company, decide to make that investment that utilizes more of Oregon's natural resources, many of which are either going up in smoke today or simply being exported into other places. So for all of those reasons, Mr. Chairman, we sincerely think this is a proper direction for renewable fuels in this state, and we would urge your passage of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Former Representative Kropp, questions? Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, last panel. Dave Nelson, Jenna Swearingen. Sorry, Ms. Swearingen. And Doug Riggs, if Mark has his, Mr. Nelson has his amendments, I don't see him. And Jim Welsh, do you want to come up and that cleanup? Great, well maybe we'll go with you last since he was going to join you with a similar perspective, Mr. Nelson. Ladies first.
Senator Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Jenna Swearingen with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I will keep my comments extremely brief. I am here in support of House Bill 2211. We're thrilled to see this bill up today. We hope it passes. It's incredibly important to our builders. Green building has become more and more important in the past few years. Locally, we have green building councils that have started in three of our local associations. We just started one in our state association, and we're seeing increased demand for green building across the state. Some of our builders have been extremely successful going in this direction, but we'd like to see some more of our affordable homes, some of our lower end builders able to incorporate green building into their homes. We're seeing the demand for it, but as the process to start building goes on, they're seeing such high costs that they don't end up using the practices. So we're thrilled about this bill. We'd love to help in any way we can to see that it passes. Thank you.
Thank you. You deserve a tax credit for staying with Mr. Chandler and Mr. Riggs all session long.
And thank standing.
Can we endorse that comment, Mr. Chairman?
That's unanimous. Doug Riggs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be brief. For the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of Idatech, which is an Oregon-based company. It's one of the nation's premier fuel cell companies. I've passed out a little handout, which I think you have in front of you. And we're here to testify both on both bills, one of which increases the tax credit for fuel cell purchases, which obviously we like. But I really wanted to point out the second one, which is as we look at the market for alternative fuels, RETSI, BETSI, alternative energy, we really think it's a comprehensive approach that the state needs. It's not just providing a tax credit for this or a tax credit for that or embracing biofuels. But it's really looking at the whole continuum of alternative and renewable technology. And on this chart, what you see is that Idatech and there are two other companies, one in Beaverton, one in Hillsboro, that make fuel cells. What we rely on is fuel that is then converted to energy with no moving parts and the only emissions being water and air. It's a remarkable technology, but we have to fuel that in some way, shape, or form. And the best fuel for fuel cells are renewable technologies, ethanol, methanol, things of that nature. So from the perspective that we have a fledgling fuel cell industry here in the state, to the extent that we can help our biofuels and ethanol and methanol industries as well, we all benefit. And so we create a situation where we create Oregon as a leader in this kind of technology. Last point I'd make is, in a previous life, I served as a staff person for a member of the Joint Economic Committee in Washington, D.C. We had a whole debate on static versus dynamic scoring of tax credits. And that's the question of, if you cut taxes or you provide a tax credit, do you actually lose money or do you gain money? And so when I heard the chairman refer to a $9 million amount of money that we have to spend on tax credits, I guess what I'd say is that, especially in this kind of technology where we have new jobs, new industry, we're not losing any tax revenue. What we're doing is we're increasing investment, increasing jobs, and increasing tax revenue. And that's the dynamic way to look at this. So I hope the committee, in analyzing all this, will look at this as a net gain and not somehow a loss in tax revenue. Thank you.
We do. We just have to convince our peers, frankly. I mean, Paul's not here. We had this last month a great deal of discussion around that. The film and video one's one that requires an investment to get, so you're guaranteed dynamic return. But we can't, Chris will tell you, you can't score the tax credit that way, so we have to eat it in the budget. And it's hard to convince, I think this committee's there, it's hard to convince our peers in the larger sense that there is a return on whether it's the film office or the film and video tax credit or Betsy or Retsy. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Nelson. I represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and the Oregon Grass Seed Growers, the Oregon Seed Council in the state of Oregon. We're very supportive of House Bill 2211. We think that that provides an opportunity for the state to solve a couple of problems environmentally. That's methane emissions from dairy lagoons, and also deal with converting and producing ethanol from straw cellulosically. We've got about 1 million tons of grass seed straw that are produced annually in the grass seed industry, and I think that everybody would like to find a long-term solution to that, to what do you do with 1 million tons of straw. We're currently shipping about 700,000 tons of that to Japan and Korea, a little bit to Taiwan. If China, for example, Japan banned importation of rice straw from China because of hoof and mouth disease, if that would be opened up again by the Japanese market, then our market is threatened, and we think that cellulosic ethanol production here in the Willamette Valley would be a great opportunity to solve two problems with that. Tax credits, we've had through the years, we've had a pot of money to try to induce people to invent things, and we've also had tax credits and pollution control facility tax credits. And what we've learned basically is tax credits bring capital to the solution of the problem. Pots of money bring kooky ideas. And so we would very, very simply support the notion of passage of 2211. Thank you.
Save that one, tax credit. Yeah. Ideas. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Jim Welsh, and then Jeff, did you want to come up with your and address the... it's up to you. You can wait or do it today. Mr. Welsh.
Chair Deckert and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh here representing Oregon Cattlemen and Oregon State Grange. And we've been following this closely. As you know, we were working with 2210. We do appreciate the committee's attention and really all the way from the governor's office to all leadership in House and Senate, and attention and consideration that we've gotten. And we support what this bill is trying to do, and we see it as a hand up, and you wonder, well how do the cattlemen fit into this? But you have to remember, they're very large property owners. Many of them would fit into the cellulosic opportunities also, because they have timberlands and they do grow a lot of their own grain crops, so they fit in very well, and the opportunities are within the whole package, I think, can benefit us, and we would like to see these move on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Miller. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Solar Industry Association, and I'm speaking here today in favor of both 2211 and 2212. We're a member organization of contractors, energy professionals, distributors, and manufacturers such as Solar World, and these provisions are very important to the solar industry, obviously. They help us attract both manufacturing and they help us to increase the installations, and they're both changing dramatically. In the past few years alone, the Northwest has seen about $1 billion of targeted buildings, manufacturing going in, both in Washington and in the state of Oregon. So this industry is growing very fast, about 30% over the last 10 years, and it's predicted to continue that for about a decade. So we have a lot to gain from this bill. And as an example of how the solar industry is growing in Oregon, last year we installed about 165 solar electric systems, and that was about 750 kilowatts of capacity. This year, one site, Portland Rehabilitation Center in the city of Portland, is 760 kilowatts. It's larger than 165 installations last year. This industry is changing very fast, very dramatically. So these tax credit changes, and especially the 2211, help to keep Oregon competitive nationwide. It's bringing in distributors from around the nation. They're calling me constantly, telling me that they're going to be coming here very soon because of this tax credit change. And those, every dollar in outside investment dollar that they bring in here on these installations brings another 30% credit from the federal tax credits that come into the state that follow them. So we definitely support the changes that are included in 2211 and 2212, and urge your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, please? Do you know offhand, and Mike Graney might, this might be here, the Hillsborough investment, did Did they use the Betsy? You could just nod. They did. Great. Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board. I may be up here a little bit prematurely, but I just wanted to say quickly for the record, since there was some discussion by the utilities on the effects of from Senate Bill 408 from last year, to my knowledge, we have had no problem with the language in 2211. I understand there might be amendments on the way. We'd like to take a look at that, when they arrive, and it may not be in for today's hearing, but we'd be happy to take a look at them. But to my knowledge, our regulatory folks have not expressed any discomfort to me in terms of the legislative ramifications, and if that changes, I'll certainly let the chair and committee members know. And but we have been supportive of both 2211 and 2212.
Okay. Did the amendments arrive? They did not. Anyone else on House Bill 2211 or 2212? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2211. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2212. And we stand adjourned. Thank you, Senator George, for kicking off with MDAC this morning.
You anticipated me.